This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Danny Wisentowski, in for Elaine Shaw. America's era of enslavement and its Civil War can feel very far away, but somehow also very close. You can find evidence of that history in St. Louis, its cemeteries, its street names, the oldest buildings. But of course, time marches on, and things, buildings, names, memorials, they fade away. It's why some things do belong in a museum. And at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois, two artifacts from that era are going on display for the first time. And here to talk about them is Christina Schutt. She is the executive director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Christina, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
So Christina, this first artifact I want you to talk to us about is an 1819 slave badge. This is from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm looking at a photo of it right now. It is square. It looks kind of dull and metallic gray color, and it's stamped with the word Charleston, the word number 181. This was for a mechanic, and it has the date of 1819. It's about 2 inches. It's kind of small, but the size of a name badge. What was this badge for?
So this badge would have been worn by an enslaved person, likely one who had the position of mechanic. So mechanic, we would think about today like a carpenter or a foreman, right? Someone who's doing work to fix things, right, in town. And this person would have worn the badge as they went about in the city of Charleston. So this would have given them a measure of movement, right? And these badges were required by the city of Charleston for a duration basically up to and through the end of the Civil War as a way to identify their enslaved population. We also know for a short time that they actually required free blacks in the city of Charleston who were working as laborers to wear badges like this as well.
When you see a badge like this, it stands out so much of how many sort of bureaucratic pieces were built into a system of chattel slavery. This wasn't common in every state, though, I understand. Why did Charleston embrace this kind of identification that really evokes, the World War II, and where we see the use of these labels in a much more overt way, a more recent way, in the Holocaust? Why did this happen in Charleston?
Well, one of the reasons that Charleston really institutes a system is in part because enslaved people actually outnumber free whites or whites in the city. And so they're trying to identify people that are both kind of freedom seekers, what we would have in the past called runaways, right? But also identifying people who have a right to have movement. Enslaved people are using these badges as a way to both communicate and connect with one another. As they're working in various industries, whether it's mechanic or we know there are badges like porter, right, for people who would have worked in the dockyards. So that's one of the reasons is that they're very scared, fearful of the movement of black people in the city. And much of it comes out of that, of the identification. There's also this interesting component that you've alluded to around Charleston's ability to profit off of things, right? And so they're finding these ways for the city to not only profit. So typically, an enslaved laborer would have been hired out, and that's why they would have been given a badge. And they would have had to wear that badge affixed to their clothing. And so their enslaver, their oppressor, would have been required to purchase this badge from the city. So it's one way the city is able to profit directly off of the hiring out of enslaved laborers, and as well as license, right, and restrict their movements.
Now, Christina, I want to move on to the next artifact, because in a way, this next artifact is kind of directed at maybe someone who would have had to wear that badge. This other artifact is a recruitment poster for the Union Army, and this is a flyer that kind of has two sides. One is this illustration showing a Union soldier holding an American flag, a banner that says "Freedom to the Slaves," surrounded by black people who are having their chains cut, a building that says public school, you know, really a vision of that future. And it says to, you know, "All slaves were made free men by Abraham Lincoln. Come and fight for the stars and stripes." And it includes a version of the John Brown song, that goes, "Oh, John Brown, old John Brown lies a-moldering the graves, slumbering in the grave," and ends, of course, on "Glory, glory, hallelujah." Why was this poster, this flyer made? Who was it directed at? And what would it have meant for someone to join the Union Army at this time?
Yeah, so these posters would have been made really to be directed to African Americans, to let them know that they could go to their nearest United States recruitment post, right? As the one of the things that happens with the Emancipation Proclamation is that it takes sort of the United States Armed Forces and it turns it into this sort of emancipating force. So as they're taking insurgent territory in the South, they're now bringing freedom to the enslaved people in those spaces. And so not only are they bringing that freedom, but they're saying, hey, enlist to fight for your own freedom. One of the things that I love about this poster is that, as you alluded to, it's enslaved people, Black people breaking their own chains. They're helping one another up. They're encouraging reading and literacy. They're encouraging all the good things that we would mark as good things for citizenship and for securing one's own freedom. And they're doing that amongst one another, right? That Abraham Lincoln has legally given them this outcome, this opportunity for freedom, and they're taking that and grabbing that as an opportunity to fight for and to secure their freedom. And we know today that about 200,000 Black men, and actually women as well, enlisted and served the United States cause and really turns the tide of the war because of it.
Christina Schutt, thank you so much for being here. Christina Schutt is the Executive Director of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. And Christina, again, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Now, we're going to stay on this topic because joining us now is someone else from the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, and he's got quite the story to tell. Reggie Guyton is an actor and creator of the one-act play Small Beginnings. Reggie, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Thank you for having me.
All right, Reggie, now you perform and created a play based on the life of someone named Robert Smalls, not someone who did not live a small life. And just as a very quick summary, after the Civil War, he was elected to the South Carolina legislature, the U.S. House of Representatives. But before that, he was enslaved and was assigned to work on a Confederate transport ship. That was the CSS Planter. Robert Smalls did something on that ship on May 12, 1862, and it made him kind of famous. Reggie, what happened next to Robert Smalls on that ship?
So Robert took the opportunity to impersonate a captain of the Planter. He and several other slaves or enslaved folks decided that they were going to make their escape with friends, and they took a route to pick up women and children who were stowed away on another ship. And then from there, they sailed through to the to Fort Sumter into Union territory, and then handed over plans and ammunition and spoke with Union officials, and then later President Lincoln.
It's just incredible. And you know, the notion of who was going to be part of the Union Army. How were enslaved people going to be part of the fight against the Confederate States? And then this, of course, happens. How did you first encounter this story? How did you start that process of trying to figure out how do I become this person for this performance?
Well, to be honest, Robert's name had been mentioned a few times, but unfortunately, there was not enough resources that were readily available at the time to explore his story. I did have a couple friends that introduced me to a children's book. There were other materials such as Be Free or Die, a book written by Kate Lineberry that details Robert's early life as well as his escape. And then from there, I was lucky enough to have time during the quarantine period of 2020 to be able to sit down and really analyze the story and figure out what this might look like to explore his history and the emotions and the rules and the subjugation that he was under. So it took me a while to sort of personally digest that from the standpoint of being a Black man, but being able to have the opportunity to sit and really sift through it allowed me to ask really hard questions and how those questions might be answered for a variety of ages.
What were some of those tough questions? You know, Robert Smalls, his position, You know, he didn't just rescue himself. He rescued his friends, his families, but he risked everyone's life in this daring escape. It must have been very difficult. What did you learn about sort of his courage, of what allowed him to kind of go beyond what a lot of folks were able to do?
Well, for me, I had to start with the fact that Robert, as a young adult or a young child, really did not have a full understanding of the world that he was born into. He grew up with a little bit of privilege. His mother worked in the house as opposed to in the field, and that allowed him to have some freedom to play with white children who were not enslaved. It was around the age of 11 or 12 that his mother really had to introduce him to the realities of being enslaved. And that meant taking him to the auction block where people were bought and sold, and taking him to Beaufort Jail where people were punished, and oftentimes harshly. To be able to visualize that and try to put yourself in the mindset of a child that is experiencing all of these cognitive dissonances and really trying to digest the frustration and inequity is that was hard, but it also it led to other questions. What did this punishment look like? Was Robert ever really in trouble? And what is being hired out as a young 12-year-old look like? You know, being separated from your family, being separated from the only environment that you knew, and having to adapt. These are the questions that informed the narration, as well as the triumph that we had to explore.
You mentioned that you get sometimes some hard questions from people who watch your performance or just react to the story of Robert Smalls. What are some of those reactions that stick with you?
The reactions, people really feel moved in a way that makes them, that you could see the gears turning on their faces. And sometimes it is a bit of a horrified expression, but there are other times where you see a little bit of hope and people saying, oh, we can't go back to that. And those are the moments that I live for, to be able to say, you know, we have come so far and yet we still have so much further to go. But seeing the children digest this and also have questions about what happened next and what are the ways that resistance happened during this time, that is a large impact for me as a person and an actor. And I've been very blessed to be able to see this happen in real time.
Reggie Guyton is an actor and creator of the one-act play Small Beginnings at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield, Illinois. Reggie, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
This episode was produced by Danny Wissentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri, St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see Time is of the essence.
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.